Hi, welcome to Today on Africa Yesterday. I am Femi.
And I am Lola.
If this is your first time listening to us, welcome, and we do hope that you come back. Please check out our previous episodes so you can know what this podcast is all about and what we'll talk about throughout this season. If this isn't your first, thank you for sticking around till this episode. We hope that you continue to check out new episodes, and we hope that they do not bore you. Thank you for joining. In this episode, we'll talk about the kingdoms that existed in Southern Africa, what their administration structure was like, the arrival of the Dutch East India Company, also known as the VOC, the reason for the VOC settlement in Southern Africa, the power transfer between the German and British governments, what led to the Great Trek, and we'll also discuss the First Anglo-Boer War and what caused the Second Anglo-Boer War.
South Africa is known to be the southernmost region of the African continent, and it comprises of countries like Angola, Botswana, Lesotho, Malawi, Mozambique, Namibia, South Africa, Swaziland, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. Before the colonization of South Africa, there were some kingdoms that existed, and we have kingdoms like Mapungwe. It existed during the 9th century to the 14th century. We have the Kingdom of Zimbabwe. It existed from 1220 to 1450. The Kingdom of Mutapa existed between 1430 to 1760. The Kingdom of Butuwa existed between 1450 to 1683. The Kingdom of Towa Dynasty existed between 1450 to 1683 or so. The Kingdom of Maravi existed between 1480 to 1891. Each of these kingdoms had their rulers, and that was before the colonization of South Africa. So the Kingdom of Zimbabwe came out after the collapse of the Kingdom of Mapungubwe. The Kingdom of Zimbabwe was a medieval Shona kingdom located in the modern-day Zimbabwe, where its capital, Luzvingo, is now called the Great Zimbabwe. Research has shown that Zimbabwe was formed from a Shona term of the Great Zimbabwe. The Great Zimbabwe was in the southeast part of the ancient city. Although the Kingdom of Zimbabwe has been established during the medieval period, which was considered more ancient because it had its occupants as early as 600 AD.
We said earlier that the collapse of the Kingdom of Mapungubwe was kind of the start of the Kingdom of Zimbabwe. So we could safely say
the Kingdom of Zimbabwe came up after the collapse of the Kingdom of Mapungubwe.
So we could safely say that humans has existed way back, even before the Kingdom of Mapungubwe started. But just that, these kingdoms were kind of like the highlights of the, you know, transition in human existence in South Africa.
We can say that. The fact that the people from the Kingdom of Mapungubwe in South Africa moved to the Great Zimbabwe brought about artistic and stone masonry traditions. They constructed elaborate stone buildings and walls in its apex kingdom.
Just like we've said in many other episodes of this season, we talked about how the movement of people from one part to the other of that region in Africa, how they brought about civilization. Like when we're talking about the Western Africa, people came from the north, they brought about civilization. Now again, I think the movement of people from one place to another before colonization actually, like, you know, took civilization all around. It's about like spreading civilization through the other parts of Africa.
We noticed that as civilization came in, most of these artistic works we had, then it inspired international trade between that country and other countries, and also it's more like their heritage, right? They mined minerals like gold, copper, and iron, and also kept livestock. So all of these helped build their economy to a very strong level that they were able to like cater for themselves before colonization.
Again, when we look at Africa as a whole and the episodes we've, you know, made and the stories we've said about regions in Africa, we notice that huge and large kingdoms actually made most of their profits from taxes. I mean, taxing the regions in that kingdom.
And so also they made quite an amount of money from the mineral resources they had, international trade, and also their artistic works.
Also, the mineral resources that Congo had, when we talk about it in the first episode, was basically what improved their economy and, you know, sponsored many countries during the World War.
The Kingdom of Zimbabwe also got to build their economy through taxing the rulers throughout their region. The Kingdom of Zimbabwe controlled the ivory and gold trade from southern coast of Africa, where economic domestication was also practiced. Also, Congo was able to produce bullets due to the copper they had to end the fight during the World War. So most of these mineral resources, let's say most of these African countries had, they were able to use it to help the country that colonized them. Some also were able to invest it in international trade, and they got more money from all of this. So they were able to build their economy base. Moving on to the Kingdom of Zulu, Sezangakona, the king of the Zulus, then had an illegitimate child, and he was sent on an exile with his mother. They dwelled at Mtetwa, where they found refuge. So when Shaka was the name of Sezangakona's illegitimate son, and after the death of Shaka's father, that's Sezangakona, Dingiswayo helped Shaka become the chief of Zulu Kingdom. Shaka was a good ruler, and he initiated military, social, cultural, and political reforms in Zulu Kingdom, in the Kingdom of Zulu. And this also helped him build a well-organized and centralized Zulu state. During Shaka's rule, Zulu was so organized and it was so centralized, because Shaka was able to build all of these through the initiation of his military, social, cultural, and political reforms.
And I think the way we've seen it in most countries, when a state become more centralized and more coordinated, they tend to have a better future in that way, and the economy really grows because everything is like more constructed and better that way.
Everything is organized, and exactly, they have their way of life, and when a country is organized, things get better.
Exactly. And
the reforms that go on in that kingdom are always very effective. While Shaka was trying to build Zulu's kingdom to be a more coordinated state, I guess his half brothers were jealous of him, and that's why in the year 1828, Shaka was murdered by his half brothers, Dingane, Mabopa, and Malagana. That happened 1828. That's actually sad news to me, because
exactly,
he was doing really good. He was doing really good. But
and I think jealousy his exile from Zulu Kingdom in the first place was more like not right. So even though he was an illegitimate son of his father, that does not constitute the right that they should, you know, send Zulu. I think it was wrong in the first place for his father to send him out of Zulu.
Yeah, that was wrong in the first place, and I think that was also what prompted the jealousy.
Exactly.
Because they were thinking an illegitimate son
that literally don't know anything about Zulu coming to rule over us. Exactly.
Yes. Even if he was doing good, nobody at that point saw the good he was doing. They saw the fact that he was an illegitimate child coming to rule over them.
And his brothers were really angry about that fact that they were supposed
to be there.
Angry
and jealous, so they decided to murder him in 1828. After his assassination, Dingane murdered Malagana and took over the throne. So one of his first acts was to execute all of his royal kin. And also in following years, he executed many past supporters of Shaka so as to secure his position. So at that point, he was so insecure. Brutal. He was so insecure. This is what led to his brutality. And exactly. First of all, he murdered all his royal kin. That means including his brothers, like anybody who
that was
had that traces to the throne, to get to the throne. Even murdered just people who were part of his plan to murder his brother.
Exactly,
Shaka.
Like Malagana.
Yeah, Malagana was part of the plan. Plan of the assassination that murdered Shaka. Malagana was part of the assassination. It was part of the people that came together to assassinate his half brother Shaka. So he murdered Malagana first, then murdered the rest of Rhea Kings.
The supporters of Shaka in the first
and
place.
And even if supporters of Shaka, so it could
I think this is something we still see. We see in some other African countries,
kingdoms, yeah,
and kingdoms exactly. And this has really, you know, laid down a difficult rule for them to come back, trace themselves back to where they missed it. Because okay, these power supporters are most likely the people who were more positive about the vision for Zulu, but he murdered
because
them
they were supporting Zulu,
was,
so obviously they
exactly
had, they had that
they
vision
Shaka.
Sorry, yeah, they were supporting Shaka, so they had that vision with Shaka. Before you could support someone, you should follow that person's vision and know, okay, does it go in line with
exactly.
mine, then we can work together.
And even this assassination will cause more tremble in the kingdom of Zulu at that point. I mean, nobody will want to go against his will. Nobody will want to do anything, whether it's right or wrong, against whatever, you know, he says.
After his assassination, I'm sure it created fear in the kingdom of Zulu. People would just want to... He already secured his position at that particular point after the assassination, so... Everyone
a lot
wants
of people
to
will
do
absolutely
what he wants.
Oppose him in their hearts, but they will never speak out.
Of course, they won't speak out. They won't be able to speak out
because
the supporters of Shaka
exactly were killed.
So who are they?
And
not
he killed his royal kin. So
who are they?
Commoners.
They're just.
This is a really brutal experience in the kingdom of
Zulu. It's a really brutal experience.
And obviously, we will still see its effect today.
Okay, so that's all we have for the pre-colonial era of South Africa. I hope you enjoyed it.
In 1652, the Dutch East Indian Company, also known as Vereeniging de Oostindie Compagnie, or in short as VOC, declared to establish a permanent settlement at the Cape to serve as a secure base camp where voyage ships could shelter and be serviced. So the point in Cape, which was later called Cape of Good Hope, was actually a point where ships that were passing across southern parts of Africa for international trade could stop and be serviced, and it was also created for restocking of the ship, so the sailors who were on board could, you know, get something to eat along their ride. At this time, there weren't proper refrigerating equipment that they could use to, you know, store their food throughout their journey. So this point served as a point where they could stop and restock foods for themselves till the end of the journey. At about the time the Dutch got to Cape, the Khoikhoi people, who were local settlers, trading with the Dutch people. Therefore, the Dutch had to fend for themselves. They had to look for what they would eat for the settlers, and also they had to provide for the ships that were passing by. Because of this, they had to fend for themselves. So a group of ex-VOC soldiers, who were called Freeburgers, took up the role of farming and cultivated a vast amount of land as they increased the number. In order to assist, the VOC also brought about 70,000 slaves to Cape Town from India, Indonesia, and some Eastern African countries. This was because Van Riebeck, the commander of the VOC settlement, considered it impolitic to actually enslave the people of Khoikhoi that were there before they got there.
Yeah, so when they got there,
they shipped
in slaves
to
help
them.
They already stopped their relationship with the Khoikhoi people. So they had to ship slaves
from all the way from Africa, Cape Verde, all that way
to work hand in hand with them
and help them, because what they were doing was actually, you know, fostering international trade. When they were helping ships on voyage, they were restocking their faith, they were servicing their ships. So they had, they stayed
there.
Exactly. They needed hands to work with them. And, you know, the ex-VOC soldiers who were there already started cultivating lands. But when this land, when the land they cultivated became very vast and they could not handle it by themselves any longer, so they had to ship slaves in. So that was the point of bringing slaves in to Cape Town. Eventually, the arms needed to cater for the development of the town went up so much that Van Riebeck and the VOC began to make indentured servants. So what they did was, the 70,000 people could not still cater for the needs of the settlement, which was beginning to turn to a town at that point. So they had to make indentured servants off from the Khoikhoi peoples. So what they did was to receive free labor from these Khoikhoi people by forcing them to sign a contract that when they work for them, they would, you know, give them something in return as a service and not in monetary value. Late 18th century, the VOC were facing bankruptcy, but in order to prevent post-revolutionary France from taking over Cape, the British seized the town in that same year just to, you know, hold a fort so that the French could not take over. But they were absolutely willing to hand over power back to the Dutch, and they did that after 8 years. That was in 1803. 2 years later, the Cape was handed over to the British totally as a prize during Napoleonic Wars. Just like the Dutch before them, they had little interest in colonizing Cape of Good Hope and were more concerned about its strategic location to the trade routes. So basically, just like the Dutch, the British were more concerned about the, you know, the shipping routes and the increasing sales it had for them, the increase in their economic activities, because, you know, they had control of the ship that were passing through South Africa at that point.
I think the Dutch were more concerned about international trade, about trade, and not colonization or
at all
trying to enslave a particular place.
But it was just like, it was just because they had to at the end of the day. That's why they made indentured slaves. And when we see that when the British also came in into the picture and took over Dutch, took over Cape rather, totally in 1803, they also came with the intention of fostering international trade rather than colonizing South Africa in that place. Some months later, after Cape of Good Hope has been handed to the British government to take over, they abolished the use of Dutch language as one of their first tasks as the government in Cape of Good Hope. And this forced many Dutch colonies to move away from the British administrative reach because they were not allowed to speak their language and they virtually do not know the British language. So they had to leave the vicinity where they were forbidden to speak their own language. Apart from linguistic changes, they also replaced the Dutch rix dollars with British pound sterling in 1824. So we can see that there is enough reason for Dutch colonies to actually move away from British reach and, you know, to a new settlement, to a new site where they can call their home.
Yeah, and that was because of the restriction in language and also the change of currency. You
know, exactly.
Nobody would love that.
Yes, no one would. Few years later, in the early 20s, the British government encouraged thousands of middle-class immigrants to leave Great Britain, many of those who eventually settled at Grahamstown and Elizabethport. The resulting mass migration, together with the high European birth rate and wasteful land usage, resulted to an acute land shortage, which was only battled when the British government acquired more land through military forces. We can see that a lot of factors actually led to the acute land shortage, which happened around 1820s. One was because the British government encouraged Britons to move from the Great Britain to Cape of Good Hope. Another was that there was high European birth rate at that point and wasteful land usage. So hence the land that they had for themselves were not enough to cater for their sustainability needs at that point. And what the resulting solution was that they had to use their military power and military influence to take more land spaces from the neighboring, you know, villages. Let's talk about the Boer people and republics. After the abolishment of the Dutch language by the British government in 1806, the Dutch-speaking inhabitants of Cape Colony trekked inland, first in small groups, then years later, in the 1830s, they migrated in large numbers, which is still today known as the Great Trek. So there were a lot of people that trekked from Cape of Good Hope, then inland of South Africa. They trekked from Cape of Good Hope to the inland of South Africa. So we've seen that one reason for the massive emigration of people from the Cape of Good Hope to inland of South Africa was because of the change of accepted language in Cape of Good Hope. Another reason was the abolition of slavery by the British government on the Emancipation Day, which was on the 1st of December 1838, which resulted in the large Great Trek. This was because many people actually had slaves that they would rather not free. And the effect of freeing those slaves on their daily economic activities was more than they could accept. In 1877, Britain attempted to amalgamate the state of South Africa under British rule, and the Transvaal Boer Republic was forcefully annexed. As a result of long-standing Boer resentment, 3 years later, in 1880, a full-blown rebellion in the Transvaal and a First Anglo-Boer War erupted. Although the conflict didn't last for long, but it ended with a decisive Boer victory on the 27th of February 1881. The Republic gained its independence as the South African Republic, and Paul Kruger, one of the leaders of the rebellion, became the President of South Africa Republic in 1883. In spite of this, the British forged ahead with the desire to federate the SA colonies and republics. In 1895, a column of mercenaries led by Captain Lander Star Jameson entered the South African Republic with the intention of rebelling against the Boer government and installing a British government there. So they were supporters of the British government and wished to actually, rebel against the government of the South African Republic and, reinstall the British government there. Unsuccessfully, the uprising that the mercenaries were supposed to cause ended when they were captured by the Boer commanders. In a suspicion by Kruger that South African Republic faced imminent danger from the Cape Colony, they formed an alliance with the neighboring Boer Republic of Orange Free State, although this did not protect the outbreak of a second Boer War. Until 1899, Paul Kruger's government excluded all foreigners from voting, but by 1899, the British government demanded voting rights for the tens of thousands of foreign whites on Witwatersrand Strand. When Kruger rejected the British demand, he also called for the withdrawal of the British troops from the borders of South African Republic. So he wanted totality to South Africans and wanted to exclude British government from anything that had to do with the South African Republic, and even, eject them from the borders of South African Republic. In retaliation to what Paul Kruger has done earlier by rejecting to allow foreign whites to vote, the British government refused to withdraw their troops, and by this, Paul Kruger declared war. This was the Second Boer War, and which lasted longer than the first and gained more local as well as international recognition than the first. Eventually, years later, after the death of over 22,000 imperial soldiers and 7,000 Republican fighters, the signing of peace agreements by the Boer Republics on 31st of May 1902 led to the acknowledgement of British sovereignty by the Boer. The British in turn committed themselves to the reconstruction of the areas.
's thank you for listening to another episode on Africa Yesterday. Please subscribe to us everywhere you listen to podcasts. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, do well to give us a 5-star review. And also don't forget to recommend us to your friends. Well, that's the only way you can keep us talking. Goodbye.
We say a very big thank you to our crew, Rachel Ononre and Femi Fadawansi. They have been of great resource to this team, ensuring we deliver quality to you guys. Thank you very much.